Hey, thanks for downloading this podcast. It's brought to you by Talking Life Across Australia and 96.5.
Hobart to Cairns,
Perth to Brisbane,
and every back street in between. We're Talking Life Across Australia.
Talking Life Across Australia, we're talking with Dr. John Patrick and talking about being a thinking Christian and engaging a world that thinks that often Christians are gullible, naive and stupid. Maybe you got a question or a comment, 1-300-85-1314, that's the cost of a local call anywhere in Australia, or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. Talking Life Across Australia with me is Dr. John Patrick and Michael Knight, and we're talking about being a smart thinking Christian. 1-300-85-1314, cost of a local call anywhere in Australia, 1-300-85-1314, or email to questions at talkinglife.com. We're going to talk with Rob from Brisbane. Hello, Rob.
Good evening. I'd just like to ask the panel that there's quite a bit of controversy in the Christian community in Australia, Queensland, about homosexuality. Some churches are actually advocating it. I was wondering if the panel and professor would comment on how it has, you know, it's clearly condemned in both Old and New Testaments, why it is now becoming acceptable to look on lesbianism and homosexuality as normal, and practicing homosexuals and lesbians are not only allowed in the church, but they're allowed to be in leadership roles as well. Mm-hmm. Is this a bad thing, or should we as Christians speak out against it?
Oh, you've got a smile on John's face, so what are you thinking, John?
Well, it's not being accepted by everyone. It's being accepted by the liberal elite who major in arguments. So initially, when they come up with some outrageous idea, they win to begin with. That's to be expected, and that's what's happening. But ordinary blue-collar guys are still holding on to their basic intuitions. And, of course, a farmer friend of mine put it very well the other day. He said, if I had a cow who did that, it'd go to market tomorrow. The future of Australia can't be sustained on that basis. There's only one organisation, one relationship that can create enough children and give enough love for free to make them reasonable children and reasonable Australians, and that's heterosexual marriage. So anything that attacks heterosexual marriage should be forbidden for purely prudential reasons. Now, homosexuality has always been with us, and it, as you rightly say, it was condemned in all of the ancient religions, although not as vigorously as one might hope sometimes. Clearly, Plato wasn't upset with it, but Aristotle thought it was objectively disordered. So there's a long history to this. Now, it's very difficult to talk about this subject. My advice to you, if you want to, is never make a statement, always ask a question. The way that I always begin when I'm asked to talk about this is I say, well, what would we do with a behavior that is associated with an increased risk of early death, internal bleeding, internal infections, liver disease, not very responsive to psychological assistance? And by this time, somebody in the audience will be getting agitated, and I say, hang on a minute, I haven't got to tonight's subject yet. I'm talking about alcoholism. And we've decided that we will do everything we can to delay the point at which our young people come into contact with alcoholism because of its health outcomes. Now, if I had been talking about homosexuality, every outcome that I mentioned, except paradoxically the response to psychological intervention, would have been worse. Why do we have double standards? Mm.
Is it in genes, as some maintain, or is it an adopted lifestyle that homosexuals actually can't help themselves? Is that as your research has ever come across? That,
well, there was a disreputable paper that was published in Science a few years ago that should never have been published, arguing that it was in the genes, and then they realised that was a bad mistake, because if you have something that's in the genes, you can get a test. And once you've got a test, you can do a prenatal abortion. And since they have such an unpleasant life, maybe we should get rid of them all that way by their own choice. And, of course, that was an argument they didn't want. So the gene thing has died down for that reason. Now, clearly, there are people who maintain, like Henry Nouwen, that they had homosexual desires that they never fulfilled, and therefore it is possible in those cases to control it. It's a behavior, and clearly nobody knows the exact cause. It's clearly related statistically, to having had a bad relationship with one or other of your parents. That's not 100%, but it's a major factor. We don't know why it's coming to the fore at the moment.
Yes, it amazes me that we're down against smoking, but AIDS and the other diseases, you know, transfer of blood and so forth like that is accepted as something normal. It's just quite crazy.
Rob, I want to come in there with a comment that I share with high school kids, is that one of the problems is that we draw our morality and our philosophy and our theology from, you know, popular culture, particularly the idiot box. And I want to come back to John's comment earlier about being a dishonest world, is that I say to high school kids, you know, how often does the moral behaviour portrayed in TV also reflect accurately the consequences of that? And the fact is that it doesn't.
No, it never does.
It never
does. Hollywood have got a lot at fault by portraying particularly these deviant lifestyles in a very positive way.
Yeah, without ever the consequences. And there's a body of research which just backs up time and time again the consequences. And it's very, very interesting because, you know, when I start to talk about, you can't say that gay relationships or gay marriage is the same as heterosexual marriage because the research says these things about the outcomes.
In any average large city, 3% of the population, which is the usual figure in any decent study for the prevalence of homosexuality, uses up half of the infectious disease speciality in that city. Now, that's a pretty expensive bit of healthcare.
That's a frightening statistic. Goodness me, half.
Yep. And the other one that I use, because I'm into counselling, is that I say to kids is that of all couple types, the ones that report the highest level of intimate partner violence are lesbians.
Yes, well, that Andrea Dorkin, who died just last year, she was a terrible case. She wanted a country for women only, and she regarded marriage as legalised rape and a violation of women's rights. And she was a sad soul.
Well, the country would only last one generation.
Well, that's correct.
That's the truth. But the point underneath this, Rob, is the challenging some of the thinking that's underneath it. And that comes back to the issue that we talked about earlier about moral relativism, is that, you know, and a misunderstanding of tolerance. And I'm interested in John's comments on tolerance because I remember Dr. Kevin Donnelly saying here in Australia is that the form of tolerance that's promoted in education is actually at risk of undermining the very principles that give it its voice.
Of course.
Yeah, that's completely correct.
Right, and we actually haven't thought that through. So there's some deeper issues that, and I think that one of the things is, and my experience, and I'm interested in John's comment in this, is that when you start with, you know, a moral high ground of the Bible says, you know, you've lost half your audience straight away.
Yeah.
And so it's about actually engaging in, as John said, asking some questions and engaging in some thinking.
Yes. That is it. That's something I never thought about. Yes, you're probably right there. That probably a turn off if you say, you know, from a biblical point of view, you know, it's a no-no. But perhaps asking questions. Thanks very much. I'm very encouraged by what you've said.
Thanks for your call, Rob.
Thanks.
Bye. Talking Life Across Australia, we're talking about being intelligent Christians and challenging the perception of the world that if you're a Christian, you're naive and gullible and even stupid. 1-300-85-1314, 1-300-85-1314, or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. We're going to talk with Johanna. Hello, Johanna.
Hello, how are you, Peter?
I'm not too bad. How was your trip away?
Oh, it was good, thank you. I'm hesitated calling in because we're just loving listening to you out here. So I want you to know there's probably hundreds of us doing the same.
Well, we're enjoying the discussion.
But I'm calling partly just to ask a kind of practical question. During the week, I was asked to present at a Senate inquiry into pregnancy counselling services in Australia. And there were five extreme liberal, I don't know what we would call them, feminist ladies on the panel who just ran the show, and it was just so difficult to be allowed the space to speak as though my opinion had any value at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was that kind of oppressive moral relativism which left no room for informed debate.
Yeah. Joanna, I'll just, is it okay if I identify who you are for our yeah. listeners, that this is Dr. Johanna Lynch, and Joanna's been on our program before. And Johanna, you've been involved in the Women's Forum Australia, as well as advocating as a medical practitioner about the sanctity of life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just came away from it basically feeling a little bit hopeless about how to debate something when a debate's not even allowed, because there's no truth to debate about, and only the people in power get to decide what's true or what goes ahead.
Oh, that's a really good practical illustration.
Yep. I know your situation very well. I had to present to the Canadian Senate last year on same-sex marriage when they'd already actually made up their mind what they were going to do.
Yeah.
The only good thing about that was that I didn't have to try and persuade them, because that was not going to happen anyway, so I could lay a guilt trip on them.
Yeah.
And you've got to think about how you're going to do that, and that's not easy. What I did with them was begin with people who they would have to respect, so they couldn't shut me down.
Yeah.
So I began with Professor Alan Bloom, who died of AIDS and was a radical homosexual. They were not going to stop me talking about Alan Bloom, except that Alan Bloom said this. He said, in the closing of The American Mind, at the end of the first chapter, he says, when I look at my grandparents, who were ignorant folk, they never went inside an institution of higher learning, first-generation Jews in America. But he says everything done in their home was spiritually rich, because they drew the reasons for the performance of their duties and their bearing their sorrows from the reference to the book, the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And they found a myriad of exemplary heroes therein. He goes on and says, they could go to the synagogue where great scholars spoke to them not from an alien perspective, but from the same perspective, while simply providing guidance and taking them deeper into the story. That, he said, is what a community is, something that invites high and low into a common story of belief that makes sense of their lives. Then he goes on and says, when I look at my cousins, all of whom are MDs and PhDs, they have no comparable wisdom. When they speak of the relationship between husbands and wives, parents and children, they speak in the language of cliché. And then I said to the Senate, it seems to me that you are in the position of the MDs and PhDs. You have no wisdom. You're putting in first place something which is very minor. The primary concern of the state must surely be to ensure its own continuance. That will not be done by what you're proposing. You will increase the health care burden on society. Why are you doing this? You will be judged for it. At which point one of the senators said, is that a threat? And I said, no, it's not a threat. I think it's a promise. And they lost their cool completely. So I had fun rather than them on that occasion.
I love your provocative nature. It resonates with me. It is a tough one, Johanna, isn't it? That almost where the opinion's already made and any other opinion is seen lesser.
Yeah.
You have to find their heroes. The key for us as Christians is to find atheists to make our case. They're always out there. There's always an honest one or two.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it's tricky, because I think there's that whole area of how to present your case as well, and to maintain being respectful of them as people, despite not respecting how they say their ideas.
Mm.
Oh, when they come up with that one, the answer's very simple. I ask them, surely there's one person you know very well where you make a distinction between the sin and the sinner.
Yeah.
And they look at you, and I say, well, it's you. Every day, there's not one of us who doesn't disapprove of some things we've done and wish we'd done better, but it doesn't stop us loving ourselves. So if we can make a distinction between the sin and the sinner when it comes to ourselves, we can surely do it with anyone else.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's just very exciting to hear people talking about thinking better.
Yeah, and I think it's very, very important that we do that, particularly as Christians, because I think that's, as I'm listening to John talk about the Canadian Senate, that's what it is to be salt and light, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes, and I don't want this to sound or be taken wrong, but sometimes we perceive being salt and light as we just go out and preach Jesus.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing is that actually, how do we engage the community and challenge their core beliefs and thinking?
Yeah.
you know, to misquote Rebecca Manley Pippitt, is to keep the salt inside the salt shaker.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Joanna.
Thank you.
Talking Life Across Australia, we're talking about being critical thinking Christians and how do we engage a world that often thinks we're gullible and naive or even stupid. 1-300-85-1314, cost of a local call anywhere in the country, 1-300-85-1314, or you can email questions at Talking Life. And before we go to our next caller, which is Joe, people have been asking about your webpage again, John, and it's the three W's, johnpatrick.com.
No, .ca, no .com. Just .ca for Canada, that's all you need.
That's it, no .com. Just
.com claims to be the world's greatest gambler, so don't go there.
Okay, so it's just johnpatrick.ca.
Yeah, you can Google John Patrick, you'll get there.
Okay, and CA for Canada, so or just Google John Patrick and you'll find the page. And it is a good web page. Michael and I were checking it out before and I've checked it out during the week. Great, lots of information there. We're talking about being critical thinkers. Let's talk with Joe from Brisbane. Hello, Joe.
Peter, how are you going?
Not too bad, yourself?
Yeah, really good, thanks, really good. I have a question for the panel. I'm a PhD student here in Queensland, and in my area of specialty is peace and conflict studies, and what is often spoken about, particularly with regards to religion of particular significance, Christianity, is the idea of the myth of redemptive violence, the idea that that people need to be sacrificed in order for the greater good, and how George Bush has really used that in his rhetoric, if you like, for justifying his interventions and wars overseas. And a few months ago, I really got down to the heart of it in a lecture I attended where I guess Christianity was being pulled apart to the extent that it was looking at this idea that, you know, how can God be a God of peace and non-violence if he demanded the violent death on the cross that Jesus underwent. The way I understand that is that while God is a God of justice and he demanded sacrifice and atonement for sin, he didn't demand the violent death that Christ undertook. And I'm not sure if I'm heading down the right track for that, but I think it's a really critical, important question for the area that I work in, and would really like some perhaps ways to address that, or maybe some thought-provoking ideas.
Joe, I wonder if it's even just with the Middle East crisis at the moment, it's a much bigger question for the whole of society.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So, well, it's interesting that you ask that question. The happiest 2 months of my life was spent in 1995 in the refugee camps with the Hutu refugees from the Rwanda war.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had a project running on the borders of Rwanda for some years, and my wife always ran the project, and she was on the board of World Relief Canada, so we were there when the war blew up, and she got sucked in and basically spent 2 years with the Hutu refugees. And I went out in the summer of 95 to see her, and she'd set me up to teach in the camps. And it was very, very interesting, because your question came up immediately. The leader, 80% of the Rwandans would call themselves Christian. They'd be in church on Sunday. And so after about 3 hours of talking to the leaders of a dozen or so camps, I guess, they said, what we want you to help us understand is, how was it that we, who called ourselves Christian, ended up killing one another? And they wouldn't listen to the people from the Peace and Reconciliation programs, because they never took faith seriously. Isn't it interesting that our psychologists and psychiatrists and peace and reconciliation folk, who say they care about the world, never care about it enough to find out what most of the world believes?
Mm.
I mean, 80% of the world are theistic. Sorry for them, but that's the truth. So I said to the Rwandans, well, welcome to the club. Human beings have always killed one another since the beginning of history. Christians are not the worst, and they're not the best. Jews have done it. Muslims have done it big time. I mean, 100,000 Christians a year are slaughtered, largely by Muslims. The biggest killers of all, though, are, of course, liberals. Whatever else you say about the French Revolution, Nazi Germany, Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot, you can't blame that on Christianity. They did it with clean fingernails, so to speak, and they weren't upset. As Stalin said, one death is a tragedy, 30 million is a statistic. And peace and reconciliation programs had better start with that problem, but they don't. So that was number one, to get that out of the way. And then to point out that conversion does not make you good, it makes you redeemed.
Mm.
And goodness is a much more complex thing. And it's only a shallow veneer that we have in our society that separates us from the kind of killings that have happened in the past. Of course, we now do it in big time in 52 million abortions a year worldwide.
Mm.
But that, of course, doesn't count, does it? That's not violence that needs peace and reconciliation.
That's progression, isn't it?
That's right. Mm. So this is, again, the failure to tell the truth about the world. But then
I agree with what you're saying. I guess at the heart of what was being discussed at this particular moment was how can God be a God of peace and non-violence?
Well, I was going to come to that next.
Oh, okay, great. Excellent.
My favourite description at the moment of what it means to be a Christian helps with that a lot. It's one that Annie Dillard brought to my attention, but it comes from Simone Weil. From the 1930s, the Jewess who was a Marxist who became a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And when asked why she believed, she said four reasons, I think. The first, the very, very rare subjective experience of God that we have. I'm not talking about warm fuzzies in church on Sunday. I'm talking about the kind of thing that Isaiah had in the temple. Real meetings with God leave us flat on our face, so to speak. The second one, she said, is the much more frequent phenomenon of meeting people who are truly holy, usually unrelated to intelligence or inversely related to education, certainly not intelligence. The third one is beauty, which is gratuitous. It's only for us. You never see an animal occupying itself with the contemplation of art. And the fourth one, which comes close to where you want to go, she said, the absolute lack of mercy in nature, which of course is absolutely true. Now that's really amazing, isn't it? How could you evolutionarily explain that we have a universal desire for a mercy that doesn't occur in the animal kingdom? You watch animals feeding. I live on a farm. They have a pecking order or an order that you try and get round at the cost of your life. And that's true of any pack of animals. There's no mercy in the animal kingdom, but there is in ours. Where does that come from? What is the nature of it? Now you come to the violence, and we don't have an explanation except what we believe to be true, that without the shedding of blood there's no remission of sin. What's going on there? There are so many theories of the atonement that the only thing we know for certain is that we don't understand it properly, because there's only one theory when we do. And as Lewis pointed out in his lovely novel, Till We Have Faces, that the rational approaches to this are not deep enough. We need something deeper. And that's what our conversion is. And we must not attempt to explain to other people in their terms what's going on at this point. The right thing to do is to bear witness, which is what you're supposed to do. And I would put it to you that your conversion experience and my conversion experience and everyone else's is what I call a non-explanatory experience. Right. It's one of the things we know for certain in our lives, but we don't know how we know. But we know the outcomes. We know what's happened to us since.
Yeah.
And it's rooted round, right at the heart of it, is the death of Jesus.
Yeah.
And Jesus' teachings have never made anyone good. But coming to him humbly in repentance and forgiveness, and asking for forgiveness, has. So we need to bear witness to that. They have got to deal with it, not us.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that's the only way the world has ever found. And sacrifice is in all cultures.
Yeah.
Currently they're sacrificing the unborn to their god of hedonism.
Yeah.
Still sacrifice. It's the human condition. The fact that we don't have an explanation doesn't matter. It doesn't make it irrational.
No. I would tend to agree with that. But
well, it's more than tend to agree. You should be very firm. When I'm accused of irrationality, I say, no, that's clearly not true. What do you call somebody who is truly irrational? And, of course, the answer is mad. What happens to their life? It falls apart. What happens when somebody gets converted? Their life falls together.
Mm.
It doesn't get worse, it gets better. Not as greatly as we would like because of this distinction between conversion and virtue, but it's a real change.
Mm.
And you do your job better, not worse. So it's not irrational, it's suprarational.
Mm.
Your department's problem is that they confuse post-enlightenment rationality with being a total description of rationality. It's only a subset.
Okay.
Within my suprarational faith, there's lots of room for the practice of reductionistic science. But within a reductionistic scientific view of the world, there's no space for my faith, which is the bigger.
Mm.
It's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Mm.
And then look at the names of the people who are on my side of the equation. They weren't stupid.
Mm. Well, lots to think about in that. Probably more questions than answers, but that's a good thing.
That's the usual way.
And that's probably the best outcome.
Absolutely, I would agree. I'm reading a fantastic book at the moment called A Place for Skeptics. And it raises more questions than it answers, but it's certainly a book for people who've become a Christian and don't want to kiss their brains goodbye, and really addresses postmodern very well.
And Joe, I think one of the things that we've got to grapple with is my observation here of Christianity in our culture is that we want to give people the answers all the time rather than actually ask people the right questions.
Sure.
Because then, you know, Jesus said if someone becomes a seeker, they'll find. And so how do we engage people to become seekers of truth rather than actually just serving up simple answers that they're going to go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that's really important.
Mm.
Excellent.
It's great to hear that as a PhD student that you're God's got you in a place where you can actually affect some change.
Oh, you never know.
Yeah.
First thing is to survive.
That's right.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm trying at the moment.
Well, like reading right books, and I think it was Larry Crabb who said, you know, or Gary Collins, one of the two, said, you know, balance. He was talking to psychology students who were in a government university, is to balance your set readings with other readings that'll bring a different perspective, and that's one of the strategies to survive.
Good on you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for your call, Joe.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Talking Life Across Australia, we're talking about being a critical thinking Christian and how do we challenge the perception of the world that we're gullible and naive. 1300 85 13 14. Cost of a local call anywhere in the country. 1300 85 13 14.
Talking Life Across Australia with Peter Janetsky. Phone 1300 85 13 14.
Talking Life Across Australia. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk with Tim from Brisbane. We'll also find out who the winner of our three-part quiz is. We're talking about being a thinking Christian. 1-300-85-13-14. Cost of a local call anywhere in the country. 1-300-85-13-14. Or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. You're listening to Talking Life Across Australia. It's coming to you from 96.5 in Brisbane and throughout Australia on the Vision Radio Network and around the world via the internet at talkinglife.com.
Wait, there's a little bit more on Track D.